It is often at this point in the lesson that I start getting a little bit nervous about the review, because I try and keep the recap down to one or two pages of notes, which translates into between 3 and 6 minutes of review so that we remember where we were as we go into where we're going. However, by the time we get to the fourth week on a lesson, which is where we are today, it gets harder to do the recap. So today, allow me a little bit of time to do a little bit extra of the framing context, and that is this: we do not live in the Enlightenment anymore. There are vestigial overtones of that era, sometimes strong ones, but children who were born after 1990 see the world very differently than their parents. It's the scientists who did this to us. They told us that the billiard ball precise, governed by immutable laws, one truth always true here and forever, view of the universe that most older folks grew up with, that view is not the best way to describe the universe as the universe is. It's a much more paradoxical place, a much more uncertain, relative kind of affair. So, when that happened, it didn't just change what happens in physics labs. It also changed what happens in history classes and literature classes, what happens in marriages, what happens at accounting firms and legislative houses. A worldview shift is such a profound and fundamental change to our minds and to our guts and to our instincts that it changes everything that we assume about life. And that means that when our worldview changes, our society changes. Our politics change, our economics change, and for our purposes, it changes how we tell our religious stories. Now, some people in the West started seeing these changes, started seeing the world through these new kind of quantum physics lenses way back in the 1910s. But the worldview really began to pick up traction in the 1960s, and it began to steamroll through our culture in the 1990s and the 2000s. And when that happened, when this worldview began to pick up such great traction, there was a corresponding precipitous drop-off in the number of people, especially young people, who were participating in the Christian religion. There had been a steady decline going on since about the 1960s, and when it got to the mid to late 90s, it just began to plunge in drop-off, and the primary constituent that was no longer part of the church were the young. And so it's not that young people, that quantum era people, didn't feel spiritual feelings anymore. It's not that they became any less spiritual. They didn't stop having spiritual hungers or yearnings or insights. As a fact, matter of fact, we'll see in one of the later lessons, there's been kind of a dramatic uptick in spiritual desire in these last few generations. Rather, the problem is that Christianity in the West had put all of its storytelling eggs into the Enlightenment worldview basket, which was great for us when people in our society still had the Enlightenment worldview. But the number of people who do is dramatically shrinking. The number of people who see the world that way are just dying off. It's like a conveyor belt. They're falling off, and no one else is coming on with that worldview. Now, big shifts like this have happened before and will happen again. Happened 500 years ago, happened 1,500 years ago, happened 2,000 years ago. It's an occurrence that happens at specific times through history. And it's just that you and I were born into one of those times when it's happening again. And the work that generations have to do in times like this is much harder, much more demanding. The religious work, the political work, the academic work, the work that generations like ours have to do is much more difficult. We have to rethink some of the most basic and some of the most fundamental questions about life. How do we know what we know? Who do we follow? Why do we follow them? Where do we go for authoritative input about what is true or not true? What makes life good or bad? what makes it right or wrong. These core fundamental questions are required of us during these times in history. I did a wedding yesterday. I do them pretty regularly. Planning a wedding ceremony today is much more demanding than it was in earlier generations. We don't go to the Book of Common Prayer and get the words of the charge and the vows and the ring exchanges and then just import those ancient, tried and true words right into our ceremony. We just don't do that anymore. The first thing that people say to me when they come to talk about doing a wedding ceremony is usually something along the lines of, we would not like to have an organized religion kind of ceremony, or we would not like to have a ceremony that is too traditional or too religious. Now, it took me a while to crack the code of what it was that these people were asking, because they were talking to me. They could easily have gone to the justice of the peace, and why are they talking to me saying, I don't want this to be religious? And so after a while, I understood what was going on, and what they were saying is, we don't see reality the way that traditional religious framework has seen reality. So we don't want a ceremony that frames spirituality the old way. Now, we don't want a civil ceremony either. We want a spiritual ceremony because spirituality is important, and we want to honor the divine and the Holy Spirit and the community and the faith, but we don't want that old framework to define the ceremony because it doesn't define our lives. So I help people through the ancient rhythm of a wedding ceremony. Why is it that we do the charge? What is the role of the community in the wedding ceremony as well as the marriage at large? Why do we say the prayers? What do we say when we say them? Why do we take vows? What points need to be covered when we are making these vows? And at the end of these discussions of framing how a wedding ceremony goes, after we have talked about why we do all these elements, usually all the elements stay the same. And as a matter of fact, many of the words even stay the same. But what changes, and this is really important, is the meaning that gets assigned to the words. Our understanding of how the ancient spiritual ritual fits into the new world that we live in now makes it a very different ceremony, even if you had a video camera and watched it, it wouldn't be all that different than what had gone on 300 years ago. Well, that's a lot of work that other generations did not have to do. Other generations, during the centuries in which there was a stable worldview, the words that were meaningful to their parents on their wedding day were meaningful to them. And they lived in the same universe that their parents and their grandparents had lived in. But in generations like ours, that is exactly the kind of work that we have to do. It's really important work, and it is the assignment that is given to us on behalf of our children and our grandchildren. It accrues to us to ask the basic fundamental questions about what we do and why we do it, to ask the core questions about the meaning of our lives and of our actions and of our religious stories and of our rituals. Why do we do what we do? And so that is the context behind why we're doing these lessons this year on being a Christian church in the quantum era. And in particular, we've been working on this one narrative, this one core fundamental questions that all Christians must ask is, how is it that we tell the story of salvation? And that's the drawing that we've seen these last weeks. Now, we're a few weeks into this lesson now. We spent the first week insisting that the word story is an appropriate and helpful way to speak about spiritual truth, even though during the Enlightenment era, we would have preferred the word doctrines. Doctrines affect an air of certitude. If we're honest with ourselves, that certitude is not really ours to have. In fact, we said, in the Judeo-Christian tradition, we have a doctrine called the ineffability of God, and that is that God can't be contained in any construct that you create. So consequently, we are disallowed to approach religious narratives with certitude. The divine life, the spiritual life, we are taught, is a reality too deep and too vast and too immeasurable to be contained in these constructs that we create to try and make meaning out of our experience. So all we have are stories. All we have are metaphors. And then we spent a week telling the story of salvation that most Americans grew up learning, most Christian Americans grew up learning. And finally, last week, we looked at the unintended and negative consequences of neglecting that bedrock truth that all of our stories are indeed metaphors. When we forget the doctrine of ineffability, that all we have are partial glimpses and similes and pointers, when we forget that, we make the metaphor the thing and fool ourselves into believing that the story we tell is in fact the final definitive word about God and what God does and what God does not do. So you'll really have to listen online because it would take too long to recap all the negative and unintended consequences that happen when the metaphor breaks down. Suffice it to say, it became painfully obvious that if we tell the Christian story this way and only this way, it is either a terrible, toxic, mean-spirited, and self-contradictory story, or it is a beautiful metaphor that tells us some powerful and wonderful truths that is only a metaphor. And when it breaks down, we leave the metaphor and go to another. It's one of those two realities. I'm suggesting the latter, which would imply that if we are going to experience this profound encounter with divine life that millions of Christians over thousands of years testify is ours to experience, then we're going to need other metaphors. We're going to need other stories. And sure enough, we have them. Five more at least. In a few weeks, the book will be out on Kindle. When that happens, I'm going to try and do one order so you can get the author's discount, and we will order a whole bunch of them together, and you'll have the book, and it'll be here. But two chapters within the book are devoted specifically to these other historical ways in which Christians have told the salvation story. I'll let you read that in the book. Today, what I want to focus on is the bedrock elements that inform how we would update this Christian salvation narrative. And I'm just going to give you the headlines, the thought process behind these headlines. You'll have to kind of figure out in the book, but it'll be pretty straightforward there. When we go back into Christian history, what elements have been part of our salvation narrative that really must be revisited? And there are two. First, we have to see that our salvation story, as it is told commonly, has been gravely reduced through the years. What was once a grand and comprehensive narrative has become a narrowed and focused and particular narrative. It used to be the unifying theory of the spiritual life, and now it is a story about a singular issue, and that is the afterlife. Or in broader terms, it's about gaining right standing with God. At important times in our heritage, salvation has been a much bigger, much more inspiring story than this reduced version that we often tell today. The second factor that I want to make sure we hit today is that our salvation story has become more doctrinal and less experiential as the years have gone by. We certainly give lip service to experience. If you've been in the church for any length of time, you've heard the expression, Christianity is not about religion, Christianity is about relationship. There it is, we're talking about experience. The problem is, I've been in church life all of my years, and I've not seen many Christian folks who really know what relationship with God means. We know that the tradition should be about relationship with God, but we don't really have hooks in our mind to hang experiences on when it comes to fleshing out that in a daily life. Rather, the focus, the emphasis, has really been about belief and getting our belief right. If you were at NRCC several years ago, you heard the parable of Fred and Wilma the goldfish. Fred and Wilma were special goldfish. They gave birth to exactly 2 offspring every 30 days. And interestingly, their offspring were also named Fred and Wilma. They lived 2 generations, as did all their offspring, and then they died. Each time a new generation was born, 3 drops of purple food coloring were added to their water. And over time, the unnoticeable and incremental change began to normalize the purpleness of water. After several generations, clear water became the aberration, and purple water became the norm. Advocates of non-purple water were branded heretics. It was a good story some time ago. It was a parable about how spiritual truths morph through the years. Incremental change that happens so slowly that it's very difficult to see begin to get normalized into a new understanding. Enough time of that goes by, and we begin to lose the origins of our great spiritual truths. The life and vitality from which these truths come seems to recede way into the past. And this devolution of process has happened in the Christian story of salvation. I'm going to just give you the headlines. Again, you can get the processing in the book. But the devolution we've experienced is primarily in this regard. Christian salvation is both comprehensive and experiential. And we've made it doctrinal and about belief. Christian salvation is a this-worldly affair. It happens in the here and now. It is an in-our-lives-and-beyond kind of experience, and the purple water reduction of the Christian salvation story has given it an emphasis on another life at another time. Christian salvation has become about getting to heaven and avoiding hell when we die. It's been given an emphasis on getting right with God. It has been given an emphasis on paying a debt that we could not pay and getting that debt paid in another way. It's been about crossing over the sin gulf in order to have access to God. And consequently, salvation has devolved into an emphasis on fidelity to these doctrinal assertions. Yes, I believe the right thing. Yes, I assent to the right belief. And slowly, the color of water that we live in has turned. Our expectation of an experiential faith began to give ground over to the expectation that we would all assert the same belief and tell the same story. And over these generations, most Christians were not taught to look for, most were not taught to expect or be about the business of looking for the bedrock reality of experiential understanding as the form of salvation. Believe the right doctrine, we were taught. Pray the right prayer. Make sure you have right standing with God. And salvation morphed through these generations to become about believing the right creed, believing the right dogma, holding the right doctrines. And when that transition happened, we paid attention to part of our heritage, but we ignored the rest. Because in the rest, in our history, salvation has always been about experience. It is something that happens to people, all people, anyone who is willing to pay attention. Anyone with eyes to see, anyone with ears to hear, something changes. Something old and toxic gets broken and destroyed and cast away. Something new gets illuminated. Something broken gets fixed. It happens, and we experience it. In both Jesus and Paul's understanding within their Jewish framework, salvation was an experience of having something broken made whole. It was the experience of having something sick or wounded healed. It was the experience of something partial, something lacking, being drawn into fullness. It would have surprised Jesus. It would have surprised Paul to hear us talk about salvation as praying a prayer so that we could get right with God. Getting right with God is important, just like getting right with people is important, and getting right with our bodies is important, getting right with our responsibilities is important. It is good to get right with God, but it is not a big enough concept to frame this most foundational part of our heritage, this most foundational part of our tradition, our salvation story. For Jesus and for Paul, salvation happened when vice was turned on its head, when malice was thwarted, when hatred was set aside, when broken trust was restored. Salvation was already a thing before Jesus came along, but the early Christians, in their experience of Jesus, saw that ancient word as a perfect description of what they had gone through, and all of a sudden that word and that idea became a big, big part of our tradition. A world made right kind of thing. In their experience of Jesus, the early Christians had a sense of life and truth exploding into their reality, overcoming the sin that they believed had separated them from God, overcoming the death that they believed was the final word, overcoming hopelessness that they were experiencing at the hands of the Roman oppression. Their experience changed their reality and expanded their reality, and the spiritual life became about hopefulness and about fearlessness, about healing and about restoration and about redemption. It became a new reality into which their lives entered. In essence, they experienced deeply what we say so often: God is good, we are safe. And when they did, they gained a new sense about how it is between humanity and God. They gained a new sense of how it is between the world, the cosmos, the society, the individual, and the divine. Salvation is about fractures being healed. It is about the partial being made whole. It is about good triumphing over evil. It is about death becoming nothing to fear. The early Christians saw something that hadn't been seen before, that many still don't see. What they saw could not be reduced into a belief. It could not be reduced into assenting to a doctrine. No, their eyes had seen something that they had not seen. Their ears had heard something that they had not heard. And they tried to still tell a story that would make meaning out of their experience, which was no easy thing, given that it was a reality category-breaking kind of experience they had in Jesus. Now, in the Purple Water years since then, we've tended to systematize those early stories about experience into a theological framework. We've called them Six Theories of the Atonement. If you want to learn about them, Google those words. You'll run into terms like Christus Victor Theory of the Atonement, or Perfect Penitent Theory of the Atonement, or Kidnap Ransom, or Moral Influence. You will hear a bunch of terms. But what you'll also find is that in our Purple Water years, we've tended to think of those stories as doctrines that we can spar over. As a matter of fact, if you put in Theories of the Atonement, the first five or six pages that will come up in the Google search are people who are wanting to debate, is this the right theory of the atonement, or is that the right theory of atonement? Is this one biblical, or is that one biblical? And they go back and forth, and they have arguments with each other, and you can find that. I just search that. Those are the first six results that come up, which is kind of not the point. Because when we take the doctrine of ineffability seriously, what we realize is that none of them is right. None of them is the correct one, because they're all metaphors that point to some dimension of spiritual experience. Now, in the book, I don't use the doctrinal names. I try and reconnect them to the experience they point toward. Terms like, I was blind, but now I see. I was dead, but now I'm alive, which points to the experience of the Christus Victor theory of the atonement. I was lost, but now I'm found. I was weak, but now I'm strong. I was kidnapped, but now I've been ransomed. I was slumbering to the reality, the divine reality that is in and around everything, but now I have been awakened. These were experiential narratives, not doctrinal ones. Christian salvation is about experience. It is not to be reduced to belief. Reducing salvation to belief, to getting the right thing, the right doctrine, this is a tragic distortion, a tragic reduction. Pray the prayer and you're good is a tragic reduction of Christian salvation. It's just not that way. When we reduce the Christian salvation story, we miss out on the experience. When we reduce it, we tend to reduce salvation down to a one-time thing that happens, perhaps on a Thursday, perhaps at 2 p.m. And we say, on that Thursday at 2 p.m., I was saved. And what we mean by that is, on a Thursday at 2 p.m., I prayed the prayer that confirmed that my afterlife will be good and not bad. When we tend to reduce it to a one-time event, we miss out on the richness that is Christian salvation. When we ask that prayer today, have you been saved? We're asking about the ritual. Did you pray the prayer? Did you say the thing? Did you do what you were supposed to do? And when we can point to the day and we can point to the hour, we have a very different spiritual experience. We have really just decided that we are in the club or out. We haven't decided if we're going to enter into this profound, transformative journey of awakening to the divine light within us. Rather, when we go back in our tradition, we are pointed to a salvation narrative that is a lengthy process that takes a lifetime. It is a comprehensive process that explains what we are doing when we are on the spiritual journey. We are being saved. We are awakening to the divine life more richly and more deeply each passing year in our lives. We are going through a process that never ends of discarding the false self and awakening to the true. We are in a process of finding new dimensions of the way and the truth and the life, a process of sharing in God's very nature that is the deepest part of us. Now, there are definitely moments of salvation, big ones and small ones. Maybe you read the article that Jamie posted on the Facebook group last week. It helps us take salvation out of this narrowed little box that we put it in and restore it back to its comprehensive, more expansive way. And in that article, there was a story that speaks to one of the ways that we can think about salvation. A father glances up from his reading after a long day's work, and his attention is gripped by the shining eyes of his 6-year-old daughter. As he looks into her eyes, he is struck by the miracle she is, by the preciousness of life, by the wonder of divine light and goodness that is resident in that little girl. And for that moment, at least, he doesn't take her quite so much for granted. For a moment, at least, he honors the divine in her. For a moment, at least, he reveres that moment in which he saw the light. Our salvation story is big enough and expansive enough to have moments like this included in it and called salvation. That's a very different proposition than coming down the sawdust trail, praying the prayer, and then being saved. Salvation is a much bigger reality that includes day-to-day moments in which we see the truth and are set free by the truth. As she sits down to pay her monthly bills, a single woman remembers that though she is far from being wealthy, she has enough to meet her bills this month. She breathes a quiet prayer of gratitude. And in that moment of transcending worry and entering into thankfulness, casting her cares upon God, she is being saved. This is a moment of salvation. To call what we're doing an update to our salvation narrative might be a misnomer, because it's actually recovery of a very ancient story that has been purpled over the years. It began as a story of experience. It began as a comprehensive story that included all that awakens us to the divine life within us. And as we recover its breadth and its scope and its passion, it points us to ever deepening, ever growing experiences of the divine life. Now, we're going to conclude this lesson next week by looking at a term that is particularly troubling to folks, many of, especially if you grew up in the conservative side of the church, and that is the term sin. Because sin is related to salvation, and how we think about sin is very deterministic in how we think about salvation. And then we'll conclude by gaining perspective on salvation from our Quaker brothers and sisters and their perspective on the interior light. So, Spirit of God, may we be being saved. May we be being made more alive to the truth, to the way, to the life. Be that so, Lord, in Jesus' name. Amen.